Chapter 7. With Bondon pushing him from behind, Jack Aubrey managed to climb up the stern ladder. But the ivory pallor of his face in the lantern light shocked Tom Pullings extremely. Pullings's look of fierce happiness and triumph vanished. He cried, "Are you all right, sir?" and sprang forward to take his arm.
"A little hacked about, no more," said Aubrey.
And he walked along the quarterdeck, blood squelching from his boots at each step.
"What is this?"
he asked, looking at a great gash in the ship's larboard rail and side, right aft.
"A bomb, sir. They got a mortar up onto the hill just as we were winning the anchor. But it was only the quarter gallery. No harm below."
"Then we can have—" began Jack, turning to look at the wreckage.
But the unfortunate twist sent such a flood of pain through him that he had to cling to a backstay not to fall, and moments went by before he could say,
"Quarter davits at last."
"Come, sir, you must go below at once," said Pullings, holding him firmly. "The doctor has been aboard this half-glass, working in the orlop with Mr. Martin. Bondon, give me a hand."
Jack could not resist. He only said,
"Close the Tartarus under all plain sail,"
and let them ease him down into the brightly lit orlop, where Stephen and Martin were each dealing with a wounded man. He sat on a rolled-up hammock, crouching in the only position that gave any relief. At some point his senses must have reeled away from him, for when he was fully aware again he was lying naked on the bloody canvas-covered chests, with Stephen and Martin examining the small of his back.
"It is not there that it hurts," he said in a surprisingly strong voice. "It is in my goddamn leg."
"Nonsense, my dear," said Stephen. "That is only referred pain from the great sciatic. We are on the very spot itself. It is a pistol ball lodged between two vertebrae."
He tapped the general region.
"There? I thought that was the kick of a horse. Nothing much at the time."
"We are all of us fallible. Now listen, Jack, will you? We must have it out directly, and then with the blessing all will be well. A week's stiffness, no more. But when my probe reaches the ball and shifts it, there will be a very great deal of pain, more than your body can bear without moving, so I must fasten you down. Here is a leather pad to hold between your teeth. There. All is fast. Now, Jack, bite hard and let your back lie as easy and uncontracted as ever it can. The strong pain will not last long. Martin, will you pass me the long-nosed crowbill now?"
Long or short seemed to bear no relation to the agony that followed these words. It was all-embracing, and it distorted his body under the leather-covered chains in spite of his utmost fortitude, and he heard a great hoarse animal noise coming from his own throat, on and on. Yet an end it did have at last, and there was Martin casting off the chains, while Stephen took the gag from his mouth and gently mopped away the sweat that ran down his face. The pain was still there. It echoed and re-echoed in great waves through his body, but it was no more than a reminder of what it had been. And each wave was less, an ebbing tide.
"There, my dear," said Stephen, "it is all over. The ball came away charmingly. If it had not, I should not have given a great deal for your leg."
"Thank ye, Stephen," said Jack, still panting like a dog as they wound a cingulum round him and turned him on his side to dress the other wounds,
right forearm, superficial but spectacular, and a deep gash in his thigh. He had not taken much count of either when he received them, but they had cost him a great deal of blood. The same insensibility was on him now. He was aware of the probing and pricking and sewing. He could see, hear, and feel Stephen at work, but it scarcely affected him at all.
"What was the butcher's bill?" he asked.
"Tolerably severe for so short an action," said Stephen. "We have no dead, but there are three abdominal wounds I do not like at all, and Mr. Bentley was cruelly bruised when he tripped over a bucket and fell down the main hatchway. While there were many kicked or bitten by the horses, an unreasonable number for a naval engagement. Take a sup of this."
"What is it?"
"Physic."
"It tastes like brandy."
"So much the better. Padine, let you and Bondon bear the captain away on this sheet. He is not to be bent, but to be laid flat in his cot. Next case."
Stephen had long been familiar with his friend's descent into sadness after the exhilaration of battle,
and when coming round with a lantern in the middle watch to see how he did, he found him awake, he said, "Jack, with your recent anguish and your loss of blood and your present pain, for sutures are always uncomfortable, you may feel low in your spirits. But you are to consider that you have taken a French national frigate of greater force than your own, together with two national gunboats and their valuable cannon, as well as two fully laden merchantmen belonging to the enemy."
"Dear Stephen," said Jack, and his teeth gleamed in the half-darkness, "I have been considering just that ever since you was kind enough to sew me up, and that is why I have not gone to sleep. But, dear Lord, Stephen," he added after a pause, "I really thought I had lost the number of my mess that bout. I scarcely noticed it at the time, and then all at once there I was a-dying, or so I supposed."
"The pain must have been very great indeed, I am sure. But with the ball gone you have no more to fear. It came out exactly as it had gone in. No turning, no cloth carried in, no laceration at all. There was a laudable flow of cleansing blood, and the wound is now quite trifling. As for the others, they are ugly gashes, sure, but you have suffered a dozen far worse, with no lasting ill effects. And if you will drink this, compose your mind, and go to sleep, you will feel somewhat better even tomorrow morning. While you may be fit for service, gentle service, as soon as the stitches are out. Your wounds nearly always heal by first intention."
Dr. Maturin had rarely made a better forecast. In the forenoon of the 13th, Jack Aubrey was carried up onto his quarter-deck in an elbow chair, and there he sat in the mild sunshine, contemplating the string of prizes and receiving congratulations.
"By God, sir," said Babington, "this matches the Cac of Fuego. You could not have succeeded more fully. But I do hope that you have not paid too high."
"No, no. The doctor himself says it is quite trifling."
"Well, if he calls that trifling," said Babington, nodding at the slung arm and the heavily bandaged leg and the waxen face, "God help us if he ever tells us we're seriously hurt."
"Amen," said Jack. "William, have you considered the Diane?"
"Yes, sir, and a very pretty ship she is, a fine narrow entry in the most elegant lines, though she is so low in the water she don't appear to advantage."
"Why, she has 12 or 18 months' stores aboard. She was going foreign, far foreign. But what I meant was all those young women walking about her deck. Have you considered them?"
"Oh, yes, sir," said Babington,
a lubricious creature who had been considering them through a telescope at close range ever since they began to appear.
"There is a particularly handsome one in green, just abaft the Hanses."
"You always was an infernal whoremonger, William," said Jack,
though without any moral superiority. Moral superiority he could not afford, since it was pretty well known in the service that in his youth he had been turned before the mast for keeping a black girl in the cable tiers of HMS Resolution off the Cape, while as lieutenant, commander, and post-captain, he had never really shone as a model of chastity.
"I remember your sailing with a whole harem of Greek wenches in the Ionian when you had the Dryad. But my intention was rather to suggest that you should pack them off home in a flag of truce together with the wounded."
"Certainly, sir," said Babington, reluctantly taking his eye from the girl in green. "A brilliant idea. No doubt the doctor will tell me which of the wounded can be moved, but now I come to think of it, I've not seen him this morning."
"Nor I don't suppose you shall, not until about noon. Poor soul, he fought like a hero in the cutting out, pistoled the French captain as neatly as you could wish, and then spent most of the rest of the night sewing up the Frenchman he had punctured as well as our own people. It was a French quartermaster he operated on after me, blood bubbling out of his lungs."
"What did he do to you, sir?"
"Well, I am ashamed to say he took a pistol ball out of the small of my back. It must have been when I turned to hail for more hands. Thank God I did not. At the time I thought it was one of those vile screws that were capering about abaft the wheel."
"Oh, sir, surely a horse would never have fired off a pistol."
"Yet fired it was, and the doctor said it was lodged hard up against the sciatic nerve."
"What is the sciatic nerve?"
"I have no idea. But once it had recovered from being, as I take it, stunned, and once I had given the ball an unhandy twist, sending it closer still, the whole thing, I shall not attempt to describe how disagreeable it was, until the doctor took it out."
Babington shook his head, looking very grave, and after a while he said,
"The Americans speak of a sciatic stay, leading from the main to the foremast head."
"So I recall. No doubt shipping it causes them the utmost agony. But there is Dr. Martin. He will tell you which of the French wounded can be moved."
Half an hour later, the whole force and its prizes, an imposing body of 10 sail covering a fine stretch of sea some 2 miles off Cape Bowhead, was standing southwest on the west-northwest breeze, with a larboard tacks aboard, moving just fast enough to have steerage way. The boats plied to and fro, lowering the wounded with great care into the Tartarus's launch, under the care of her surgeon, while the girls, together with a disagreeable old woman, understood to be a procuress, were handed down with a much greater degree of merriment into the Surprise's pinnace. The boats stepped their masts, set sail, and bowled away for St. Martin's with a flag of truce. The squadron had worn twice, and it was crossing the harbour mouth again, the returning boats could be seen near the breakwater, when Dr. Maturin came on deck, a cup of coffee in his hand. Having bade his shipmates good morning, and having asked Jack how he did,
"Amazingly well, I thank you, so long as I sit still, and am infinitely obliged to you for your care of me. Will you just cast a glance at that beautiful Diana stern?"
Stephen turned and said,
"Captain Pullings, my dear, may I have a boat to go and see my prisoner in the Diane? I desired Bondon to put him in the hold with the rest, so that he should not be in the way during the towing."
"Bondon will pull you across himself, sir. Pass the word for Bondon." Once again, Stephen Maturin took a chair from the grapes to Shepherd Market. Once again, Sir Joseph opened the door to welcome him, but this time they both had to carry the files and bundles of paper into the library.
"Sit down, my dear Maturin, and let us drink a glass of Madeira while we recover our breath. But first let me congratulate you and Aubrey on your famous victory. I have seen no more than the very brief report transmitted to the Admiralty, but reading between the lines I see that it must have been one of those brilliant, dashing expeditions in which our friend excels, and of course I have heard the roar of public applause. Yet from your reserved, and indeed, forgive me, melancholy air, I am afraid that although the affair has certainly answered Aubrey's ends, it has not done the same for you. Perhaps the Diane was not all I represented her to be?"
"Not at all. She was indeed intended for the very same mission to the Spanish colonies, forestalling us, and these papers show the names of all those with whom the French agents might profitably enter into contact, together with a quantity of other information, such as the sums already dispersed to various officers and so on. There is also a plethora of other folders that I have not decoded, probably appreciations of the local situation by resident correspondents.
Well, my angelic doctor, what more could you ask?" cried Sir Joseph, caressing the files with a voluptuous hand and running quickly through the headings. "Here is all our work done for us. Their agents are all betrayed, their schemes laid open. How can you look so sad?"
"Because I should have brought the Red Admiral too, the author of half these notes."
The Red Admiral was a French sea officer called Segura, who had distinguished himself in the massacres after the Allied evacuation of Toulon, and who had joined one of the intelligence services. He was not, in fact, an admiral, but he was a singularly cruel and bloody-minded man, and now he was one of the most important members of his organization.
"I had him, bound hand and foot in the bottom of the launch in the first few minutes of the attack. Then, when the Diane had to be towed out, I had him placed in the hold with the other prisoners. There, with criminal levity, I left him until the next day, and by then the wicked dog, wearing a skirt and with a bloody clout round his head, had gone ashore with the women and the lightly wounded. We searched and we found his breeches, with the waistband marked Segura Paul."
"Oh, you must have cursed, dear Maturin. It must have vexed you to the very heart. I believe I should have gone near to cutting my throat or hiring someone to hang me. But when you had time to reflect, you cannot have failed to perceive that apart from the personal satisfaction, his presence was of no real consequence, and that his absence in no way diminished your triumph. Even under very great pressure, he could not have told us more than is set out in these papers, for unless I am very much mistaken, they lay out the whole of his department's reflection on the matter, together with the agent's instructions.
We could perhaps have induced him to tell us where they had concealed the sums intended to convince the officials in South America, the equivalent of that monstrous amount I recovered last voyage. The hull must certainly represent a first-rate ship of the line at the very lowest estimate, and I should like to think that I had added such a vessel to the service. After all, Jack Aubrey sank one of theirs when he had the horrible old Leopard, which is much the same thing in reverse.
There you may set your mind at rest. The Diane will certainly be brought into the service, and the shipwrights will go through her with a fine tooth comb. We have, in fact, two men who are particularly skilled in these matters, and it will be strange if their minds do not work along the same lines as the Frenchman's.
You are a present comfort, Sir Joseph, dear. It was stupid of me not to have thought of that.
He smiled, nodding to himself and sipping his Madeira. Then he said,
"This tooth comb, now, this fine tooth comb that the worthy shipwrights will be using, we often hear of it. It appears in daily speech, and yet who has ever combed his teeth, in this or any other day?
May it not be that the fine qualifies the tooth rather than the comb? That what is intended is a comb with fine teeth, that is to say, with thin teeth set close together?"
"Of course, of course," said Stephen, clapping his hand to his forehead. "This is not my most brilliant hour, I find, and I will confess that I am equally stupid about the present situation as far as it affects Aubrey. May I beg you to enlighten me?"
"If he had still been on the list, this would have been a knighthood, even a baronetcy. He would have had one for the Vark Samhite if his lamentable old father had not kept on harrying the ministry and the commons. But even so, this feat, coming on top of the coup in the Azores, has aroused a fine pitch of enthusiasm in the service, and, what is more important for our purposes, in the public. There are ballads in the street already. Here is one I bought yesterday. The poet feels that Aubrey should be made a duke, or do strawberry leaves come down lower than dukes?"
"I fancy they may descend as far as mere earls, but I am not sure of that," said Stephen, taking the broadsheet, which began,
"The ermine robe, the golden crown, and the leaves of strawberry, O. Who's the tar we'll see in town? Sure, 'tis Captain Aubrey, O. Who smote 'em low, who smote 'em high? Hey, the leaves of strawberry, O. Who did the Frenchmen in the eye? Sure, 'twas Captain Aubrey, O. In Martin's Port the other night, hey, the leaves of strawberry, O. Who woke them with a horrid fright? Who but Captain Aubrey, O."
"Well," said he, "one cannot but approve the sentiment. But allow me to break off and ask whether there is any news of General Aubrey?"
"There is nothing certain, but that remarkably sharp, pertinacious, intelligent man of yours, Pratt, believes he may be on a true scent at last in the North Country."
"So much the better. Now may we return to the present situation? I perfectly see that as a mere civilian Jack Aubrey cannot look for a title, which in passing I may say he probably would not desire. But can he look for reinstatement, which he most certainly does desire with all his heart and soul?"
"Maturin," said Sir Joseph, after a considering pause, "I wish I could say yes, and in the near future rather than at the next coronation. But there is something damned odd about the whole situation."
He drew his chair nearer and went on in a low tone.
"I told you some time ago that I was not satisfied with the way Ray and Ledward were pursued after we had made such a cock of taking them. It should not have been possible for them to leave the country, yet they did leave the country. I suspect they have some very highly placed ally. This ally would naturally be opposed to Aubrey, and his presence would help to explain the inveteracy against our friend. An inveteracy that goes beyond the ministry's dislike of him for having used him so ill, beyond their hatred of his father's radical associates, beyond their extreme reluctance to admit they made a mistake. Yet on the other hand, here are people who were ill-disposed and who are now well-disposed, Melville and some of the junior lords, for example, as well as several respectable members. And naturally there is the great force of public opinion. My impression is that at the present moment the balance is tolerably even, and that if we—"
The little silver bracket clock struck the hour, and Sir Joseph stood up.
"Forgive me, Maturin," he said, "but I had no dinner and am perfectly faint with hunger. Besides, I asked Charles to keep us the corner table by the window, and if we are not prompt it will be torn from him."
They walked down to their club, and once again Stephen observed the discreet nods and becks, the quiet, "Give you joy, sir," that were directed at him as one connected with a splendid victory. Their corner table in the supper room, over by the far window and remarkably secluded, was waiting for them, and in the few minutes that elapsed before the appearance of the boiled fowl with oyster sauce, his usual supper dish, Sir Joseph eagerly ate pieces of bread.
"As you are no doubt aware," he said, "the official dispatch, or rather report, was extraordinarily laconic. All it said was that the Surprise, having been honoured with instructions to intercept the Diane, proceeded to St. Martin's and removed her from her moorings there on the night of the 12th instant, together with the ships and vessels named in the margin. They were towed out of the harbour with the assistance of boats from HM ships and so on, and delivered to the Port Admiral at Plymouth. Of course, there have been more unauthorised accounts in all the papers than one more sensational than the last, together with a factual statement of receipt from Plymouth. But I should be very glad to hear—" At this point the fowl was placed on the table, and Blaine, having served Stephen, was about to engulf a leg when the Duke of Clarence came hurrying across the room, larger than life, in a bright blue coat with a Star of the Garter gleaming on his manly chest. They leapt to their feet as he hailed them in his powerful voice.
"Maturin there! How d'ye do?" shaking his hand. "Sir Joseph, good evening to you. As I was leaving, Joe told me the doctor was here, so I thought I should just run in and ask him how he did, though I have not 2 minutes to spare."
Blaine looked despairingly at his chicken and wiped away a dribble of saliva.
"Was you there, Maturin? Was you there with Aubrey at St. Martin's?"
"I was, sir."
"Was you, though? Was you? A chair there! Light along a chair, Arthur. Sit down, gentlemen, let me hear about it between bites. Lord, I wish I had been with you, Maturin. It was the completest thing, from what I understand, though I don't suppose you saw much of it in the orlop."
A man in black walked swiftly over from the door and murmured in the royal ear. The Duke stood up.
"They are waiting for me," he said, "and I have to go down to Windsor early in the morning. But I tell you what, Doctor, let Aubrey know that when he comes to town I should be very glad to see him. My compliments, and should be very glad to hear it all from his own lips when next he comes to town."
"Another 5 minutes and I should have grown sullen," said Sir Joseph, wiping his lips some time later. "I might indeed have committed lese majesty. Now, Maturin, if you are a little less sharp-set, you will oblige me with a really full account, bearing in mind that I am no great seaman."
He listened attentively, watching the explanatory crusts with keen intelligence. At the end he sighed, shook his head, and observed, "As the Duke said, it was the completest thing."
"It would, I believe, have been the perfect cutting out, but for those infernal gunboats and the ebbing tide. If it had not been for those few minutes, which allowed the Diane's on shore and the soldiers to come down, I think we should have carried her away with no blood shed at all."
"It must indeed have been a very severe engagement until the gangplanks parted. You did not mention the number of casualties, I think, and I forgot to ask, being carried away with a general triumph."
"We had no men killed, though we had a power of wounded, some of them gravely."
"You were not hurt yourself, I trust?"
"Never a scratch, I thank you, but Aubrey had a pistol ball within an inch of his spinal cord, and closer still to his great sciatic."
"Good God! You never told me he was wounded."
"Why, it is nothing much of a wound now, though it was near to being his last at the time. We extracted the ball very prettily, and the small hole, for it was no more, is healing as I had hoped. But he also had a couple of slashes, thigh and forearm, that cost him half the blood in his body, he being so active at the time."
"What things you tell me, Maturin! Poor fellow! I am afraid he must have had a great deal of pain."
"The extraction of the ball and the period just before was cruel indeed. But as for the rest, you know, people feel surprisingly little in the heat of battle. I have seen horrible wounds of which the patient was quite unaware."
"Well, well," said Blaine, meditating. "That is some kind of a comfort, I suppose. But I dare say, having lost so much blood, he is tolerably pale."
"His face might be made of parchment."
"So much the better. Do not think me heartless, Maturin, but a pale hero is far more interesting than a red-faced one. Can he be moved?"
"Certainly he can be moved. Did I not carry him back to Ashgrove Cottage, where he is now walking quietly about among his roses,
putting soft soap to the green fly.
"Could he be brought as far as London, do you think, in easy stages? I ask because it seems to me that this is the very moment to produce him to the public gaze, and even more to the gaze of some of the men who helped to make decisions. But you feel the journey would be too much, I collect?"
"Not at all. With well-sprung carriages, and they driven gently on modern turnpike roads, a man might be in his easy chair all the way. No, it is that I have kept him to pap almost entirely, and I have cut off all wine, spirits, and malt liquors, with the exception of a tablespoon of port before retiring. Then again, he sometimes shows signs of that nervous irritability so usual among the convalescent, and he might not do himself justice in a large gathering."
"I could limit it to a short dozen."
"And I could give him a comfortable dose that would ensure a benign tranquillity, if not any very high degree of brilliance in discourse. Yet to what extent is a physician entitled to manipulate his patient in anything but strictly medical matters? Perhaps you will allow me to reflect for a while." They took their coffee in the library, and as they sat there, Stephen said, "The invalid's pettishness may set in very early. We had a striking example of that in Shelmerston. The captured ships had gone off to Plymouth to be condemned in the prize court, and the surprise was alone when a Royal Navy sloop stood into the harbour, crammed with men. Her intention was only to escort and even sail the surprise to dock, where the Port Admiral wished her to be repaired in the Royal Yard at the King's expense. But the hands, many of whom were liable to be taken up on a variety of charges, particularly desertion, did not know this, and they were determined to make the sloop stand right out again. There were no quarter-deck officers present, all of them having gone off with the prizes. Captain Aubrey was composing his report at the time, but as soon as he heard their voices raised he came on deck in a very furious rage and reduced them to silence. Goddamn swabs, lubbers, not fit to man the Margate hoy. Never to be sailed with again, 100 lashes all round, damn their eyes, damn their limbs, sodomites, all of them. They were to let the boat come alongside at once and hand the young gentleman aboard with man-ropes. Did they not know what was due to the King's coat? Forward pack of scrovies, they should all be cast on the beach within the hour."
"Were they very much distressed?"
"They were not. They knew they had to look dumbfounded, amazed, shocked by their dismission, and they did so to the best of their ability. In the event, he forgave them, and advised those who thought it better not to be seen in Plymouth to go ashore at once."
"So she is being repaired at dock. Come, that was handsome in Fanshawe. Was there much damage?"
"A bombshell carried away the little privy and washing place on the larboard side, no more. It does not greatly signify, since there is another to starboard, and its absence will allow the erection of a kind of crane, a desirable crane." Sir Joseph nodded, and after a while he said,
"Yet I cannot but feel that if Aubrey were to go off to South America now, for I take it you will pass him fit for service quite soon,
once the repairs are done and the vast quantities of stores are in, he can sail with a quiet mind, above all with such a second as Tom Pullings."
"Very good. But if he were to go off to South America now, he would sail away far out of public knowledge. He would sail away into oblivion, and even if he were to defeat all the French and American vessels in those parts, at the cost of his right arm and an eye, he could not reach home in time to profit by his glory. That is to say, in terms of public acclaim and its official consequences. In 2 or 3 months, the glory would be cold. He would never have the same favourable combination of circumstances again. He would have missed his tide."
"Indeed," said Stephen, "that is a very grave consideration." All his naval life he had heard these words, both in their literal and their figurative sense, and sometimes uttered with such concern that they might have referred to the ultimate, the unforgivable sin. And they had acquired a great dark significance, like those used in spells or curses.
"If he were to miss his tide, that would be very bad."
Sir Joseph's rarely used long dining room could not be faulted. It was old-fashioned, walnut rather than satin wood or mahogany, but the severest shrew could not have found a speck of dust. The 12 gleaming broad-bottomed chairs were exactly aligned. The cloth was as white as newly fallen snow and as smooth, for Mrs. Barlow would have none of those folds whose rigour so often spoilt the pure flow of linen. And of course the silver blazed again. Yet Sir Joseph fidgeted about,
tweaking a fork here, a knife there, and asking Mrs. Barlow whether she was sure the removes would be hot, and whether there would be plenty of pudding.
"The gentleman is particularly fond of pudding. So is Lord Panmure."
Until her answers grew shorter and shorter. And then he said,
"But perhaps we should alter the whole arrangement. The gentleman is wounded in the leg, and no doubt he should be able to stretch it out on the leg rest in the library. To do so comfortably, he would have to be at the end of the table. But which leg, and which end?"
"If this goes on another 5 minutes," said Mrs. Barlow inwardly, "I shall throw the whole dinner out into the street, turtle soup, lobsters, side dishes, pudding and all."
But before the 5 minutes had passed, before Blaine had even displaced more than a couple of chairs by way of experiment, the guests began to arrive. They were an interesting body of men. Apart from the two colleagues Blaine had invited from Whitehall, four were fellows of the Royal Society. One was a politically active bishop. Others were country gentlemen of considerable estate, who either owned their boroughs or represented their counties. And of the two city men, one was an eminent astronomer. None of them belonged to the opposition. But on the other hand, none of them held any office or desired any decoration. None was dependent on the ministry, and all of those who had seats in the Commons or the Lords were capable of abstaining or even of voting against the government on an issue where they strongly disagreed with official policy. And those who did not have seats were nevertheless men whose advice carried weight with the administration. For occasions of this kind, Sir Joseph hired men servants from Gunter's, and the splendid butler had announced 9 gentlemen before calling out,
"Dr. Maturin and Mr. Aubrey."
The gathering looked eagerly at the door, and there, next to Maturin's slight form, they saw an exceptionally tall, broad-shouldered man, thin in his black coat, pale and severe. Part of the pallor and severity was caused by extreme hunger. Jack's stomach was used to the naval dinner time, several hours before that of fashionable London, but his wounds had their effect upon his colour too, while almost the whole of his severity was an armour against the least hint of disrespect. Blaine hurried forward with his congratulations, his thanks for this visit, and his anxious hope that Mr. Aubrey's wounds did not cause him very great inconvenience. Would he like a leg rest at table? He was followed, sooner than etiquette allowed, by a round pink man in a cherry-coloured coat, whose face fairly radiated goodwill and friendliness.
"You will not remember me, sir," he said with a particularly engaging bow, "but I had the honour of meeting you once at the bedside of my nephew William, my sister Babington's boy, when he was hurt during that glorious action of yours in the year 4. One of your glorious actions in the year 4. My name was Gardner until the other day. Now it is Merrick."
"I remember it perfectly, my lord," said Jack. "William and I were speaking of you not a fortnight ago. May I offer my best congratulations?"
"Not at all, not at all," cried Lord Merrick. "The boot is on the other foot entirely. Being shifted from one house to another is not to be compared with cutting out a frigate, I believe."
He said several other most obliging things, and although his words were mostly drowned by the greetings of the men Jack already knew, and by Sir Joseph's introduction to the rest, their evident sincerity could not but please. None of the other guests quite came up to Lord Merrick. They lacked his complete simplicity, yet their cordial, unfeigned congratulations would have satisfied a man with a far higher notion of his deserts than Aubrey. His reserve and severity, never natural to him until these last months, quite vanished, and the change was made all the quicker by Sir Joseph's sherry, which spread an amiable glow in his pinched, abstemious belly. Babington's uncle absolutely insisted upon giving him precedence, and Jack sat at Blaine's right hand in a pleasant state of mind and a lively anticipation of the turtle soup that his practised nose had long since detected. The bishop said grace. The promise became reality, green calipash and amber calipees swimming in their juice, and after some moments Jack said to Blaine,
"These classical fellows may prate about ambrosia till they go black in the face, but they did not know what they were talking about. They never ate turtle soup."
"Are there no turtles in the Mediterranean, sir? You astonish me."
"Oh, yes, there are turtles. but only loggerheads and the sort they make tortoise shell of. The true turtle, from the Ambrosian point of view, is the green one, and to find her you must go to the West Indies or Ascension Island."
"Ascension Island!" cried Lord Merrick. "What vistas that calls to mind! What oceans of vast eternity! In my youth I longed to travel, sir. I longed to view the Great Wall of China, the deadly upas tree, the flux and reflux of the fabled Nile, the crocodile in tears. But in crossing to Calais I found it would not answer. My frame would not bear the motion. I waited in that vile town until a day of total calm, a true halcyon day, and then I was rowed gently back, still half dead and far gone in melancholy. Since then I have travelled, fought, suffered, survived, and conquered solely in the person of William. Such things he tells me, sir! How you and he, in the Sophie of 14 guns, took the Cacafuego of 32. And so he went on, with an accurate account of Aubrey's battles, and Aubrey had been unusually favoured in the way of action, until the two country gentlemen on the other side of the table gazed at Jack with renewed respect, even wonder, for it was in fact a most uncommon record, and one told with complete sincerity.
"Mr. Aubrey," murmured Blaine,
interrupting the flow just where the surprise was sinking a Turk in the Ionian,
"I believe the bishop means to drink to you."
Jack looked down the table, and there indeed was the bishop, smiling at him and holding up his glass.
"A glass of wine with you, Mr. Aubrey?" he called.
"With the utmost pleasure, my lord," replied Jack, bowing. "I drink to your very great happiness."
This was followed by several more glasses with other gentlemen, and Stephen, halfway down the table on the other side, observed that the colour was coming back into Jack's face. Perhaps rather more colour than he could have wished. A little later he also observed that his friend had launched into anecdote. Jack Aubrey's anecdotes were rarely successful. His talent did not lie that way, but he knew his role as a guest, and now with a candid look of pleasure at his immediate neighbours, he began,
"There was a bishop in our part of the country when I was a boy. The bishop before Dr. Taylor, and when he was first appointed he made a tour of his command, of his diocese. He went everywhere, and when he came to Trotton, he could hardly make out that such a scattered place, just a few fishermen's huts along the shore, you know, could be a parish. He said to Parson West, an excellent fisherman himself, by the way, he taught me to sniggle for eels, he asked Parson West."
Jack frowned slightly, and Stephen clasped his hands. This was the point where the anecdote might so easily break down again, an unhappy echo of the word place, P-L-A-C-E, appearing as place, P-L-A-I-C-E, in the bishop's question.
"He asked Parson West, 'Have you many souls here?'
Stephen relaxed.
"And Parson West replied, 'No, my lord, only flounders, I'm afraid.'"
Jack Aubrey, pleased at the kind of reception of his tale, pleased at having got it all out in one piece, and pleased at having fulfilled his social duties for some time to come, applied himself to his excellent mutton, and the talk flowed round him. Someone at the bishop's end spoke of the curious French ignorance of English titles and ways, and one of the Whitehall men said, "Yes, when Andreas here was here as Bonaparte's envoy, he wrote to my chief as Sir Williamson, Esquire. But he did worse than that. He intrigued with the wife of one of our colleagues, a Frenchwoman, and having heard that the Devonshires were in a very sad way, he sent her to the Duchess with a plain, downright barefaced offer of £10,000 for cabinet secrets. The Duchess told Fox."
"It is ignorance that will lose the French this war," said his neighbour. "They began by cutting off poor Lavoisier's head, observing that the Republic did not need men of science."
"How can you speak of French ignorance when you compare their attitude towards balloons with ours?" cried the man opposite him. "Surely you must recall that from the beginning they had an aerostatic corps, and that they won the Battle of Fleurus almost entirely because of the accurate information derived from balloons poised at an immense height over the enemy. His numbers, his dispositions, his movements were all open to view, but what do we do about balloons? Nothing."
"The Royal Society decided against them,"
said the bishop. "I particularly remember the reply when the king offered to pay for some trials, because I was in the closet when it came. No good whatsoever can be expected from such experiments," said the society.
"A part of the society," said one of the fellows sharply. "A very small part of the society. A committee largely made up of mathematicians and antiquaries."
The other fellows present disagreed with this, and with each other. But Aubrey and Maturin, though much attached to the society, were often abroad. They had little knowledge of its often passionate internal politics, and less interest. Neither took any part in the discussion. Stephen devoted his whole attention to his right-hand neighbour, who had made an ascent, and a glorious ascent, at the time of the first enthusiasm before the war. He was too young and foolish, he said, to have recorded any of the technical details, but he did still retain that first vivid sense of astonishment, awe, wonder and delight when, after a slow, grey and anxious passage through mist, the balloon rose up into the sunlight. All below them, and on every hand, there were pure white mountains of cloud, with billowing crests and pinnacles, and above a vast sky of a darker, far darker, purer blue than he had ever seen on earth. A totally different world, and one without any sound. The balloon rose faster in the sun. They could see their shadow on the sea of cloud, faster and faster.
"Dear Lord," he said, "I can see it now. How I wish I could describe it. That whole enormous jewel above, the extraordinary world below, and our fleeting trace upon it. The strangest feeling of intrusion."
The cloth was drawn. The time for toasts was coming, and Jack rather dreaded them. His wounds, his recent milk-and-water diet, and the lack of exercise had lowered his resistance, and even from the moderate amount he had drunk already, his head was not as solid as he could wish. He need not have been afraid. After they had drunk the king, Sir Joseph sat musing for a little while, fitting two walnut shells together. On his left hand, Lord Panmure said,
"Not long ago that toast stuck in a quite extraordinary number of throats, quite extraordinary. Only yesterday Princess Augusta told my wife that she never really believed in her rank until the Cardinal of York was dead."
"Poor lady," said Blaine. "Her scruples did her honour, though I fancy they were highly treasonable. But she may be easy in her mind now. It would never have stuck in your throat, I dare say, sir," turning to Jack.
But Jack was still following an account of Babington's description of HMS Leopard's encounter with an iceberg in the Antarctic, and her repair on Desolation Island. He had to be disengaged, and the question put to him again.
"Oh, no," he said. "I have always followed Nelson's advice in that, as I have in everything else, as far as my powers have allowed me. I drink to the king with total conviction."
Blaine smiled, nodded, and turned back to Lord Panmure.
"What do you say to taking our coffee in the drawing-room? It is so much easier to circulate, and I know there are many gentlemen who would like to speak to Aubrey."
Many of them did indeed speak to Aubrey, and as the evening wore on, Stephen saw him growing paler and paler.
"Sir Joseph, my dear," he said at last, "I must take my patient away and put him to bed. Please may his servant be told to fetch him a chair."
The servant in question, Preserved Killick, was drunk. Drunk even by naval standards, incapable of movement. But Padine was at hand, and sober, and in time he brought two chairs, carried by Irish chairmen, the only ones who could understand him. During the delay, one of the Whitehall men, Mr. Soames, drew Jack aside and asked him where he was staying, asked, too, whether he might have the honour of waiting on him. There were one or two questions he would like to ask.
"By all means, I shall be very happy," said Jack.
But he had almost entirely forgotten him the next day, when Mrs. Broad of the Grapes announced, "Mr. Soames to see you, sir." Jack received him with decent urbanity, although yesterday's unaccustomed food and wine were still with him, hanging like a debauch, while his leg wound was itching extremely, and his spirits were ruffled by an interview with a sullen, dogged Killick, who among other things had lost, or failed to pack, a book promised to Heneage Dundas, and now to be carried out by a friend bound for the North American station. They exchanged remarks on the previous evening, Sir Joseph's capital wine, the near certainty of rain later in the day, and then,
"I find a certain difficulty in opening my errand,"
said Mr. Soames, eyeing the tall figure opposite him.
"I am most unwilling to seem busy."
"Not at all," said Jack, in a reserved tone.
"The fact of the matter is that I have been asked to have a few unofficial words with you on the possibility of a favourable outcome in the event of a proper solicitation for a free pardon."
"I do not understand you, sir. A pardon for what?"
"Why, sir, for that unfortunate affair at the Guildhall to do with the Stock Exchange."
"But surely, sir, you must be aware that I pleaded not guilty, that I said upon my honour that I was not guilty."
"Yes, sir, I remember it perfectly."
"Then how in God's name am I to be forgiven for what I have not done? How can I conceivably solicit a free pardon when I am innocent?"
Jack had begun the interview in a state of strong, ill-defined, diffused irritation. He was now white with anger, and he went on,
"Do not you see that if I ask for a pardon, I am giving myself the lie, proclaiming that there is something to be forgiven?"
"It is no more than a formality. It might almost be called a legal fiction, and it must affect the question of your eventual reinstatement."
"No, sir," said Jack, rising. "I cannot see the matter as a formality at all. I am aware that neither you nor the gentleman who desired you to speak to me means any offence, but I must beg you to return them my compliments and state that I see the matter in a different light."
"Sir, will you not consider for a while and take advice?"
"No, sir. These are things a man must decide for himself."
"I regret it extremely. Must I then say you will not entertain the suggestion?"
"I am afraid you must, sir,"